Well, good day, everybody, and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with some great information for you and a little bit of a shift in what you might be expecting from the topic of the evening, but I'll save that for a little bit later on. Before we can get into the topic of the evening, we have to get into the star of the evening, and of course, that's always my co-host, Sam Bradley.
Well, thank you, Jamie. Gee, I've gone to newer heights here. Yes, we're sitting in Longmont, Colorado, which is kind of a nice area, and I'm here with this meteorologist who happened to be taking a dispatch class this week, so he wasn't so far away that I couldn't meet up with him, and that's been kind of fun. So let's go to the weather, Kyle Nelson, that's sitting next to me.
Ah, well, thanks, Sam, and hello, everyone there in Disaster Podcast land. Meteorologist Kyle Nelson here with a quick look at the disaster weather roundup. So first and foremost, wildfires continuing to rage across the western U.S. As of this past Friday, September 28th, almost 49,000 fires have burned close to 8 million acres nationally. California leading that charge, with close to 1.5 million acres burned so far just in 2018. Looking back now across the Pacific to our friends in Indonesia, the earthquake that occurred there on Friday and the subsequent tsunami that occurred, that resulted in, you know, collapsed bridges, completely leveled buildings, and over 800 fatalities reported so far. And the eyewitness videos are just absolutely staggering to watch and to hear people trying to alert their fellow citizens. And the quake was actually so powerful, this really struck me, that it actually displaced or shifted the land anywhere from about 18 to 25 feet in the horizontal.
Whoa.
So big shift there, big impacts. And that area will be, they're only beginning to realize the extent of the damage due to all the infrastructure that was taken offline.
I heard some stories that it actually caused the ground to become almost liquid and that it actually rose up around buildings. And they are not sure how many people are trapped in those situations where, you know, the ground just basically became liquid and the buildings
liquid
either sank
action,
in,
yeah.
You know, or the buildings sank inside them or the ground came up around them, whichever you want to think. But that's just horrifying to think about.
Well, Indonesia sure has taken their hits in the last several years. What else you got, Kyle?
So looking a little bit closer to home now, our friends on the East Coast, in the Northeast, specifically in Pennsylvania and into New York, at least half a dozen tornadoes touched down just last night, with several being reported, including all the way from northern Pennsylvania all the way out to Long Island, where tornadoes have been confirmed.
Wow.
With at least one EF2 tornado being confirmed so far in northern Pennsylvania, and hail up to the size of limes being reported up there. So tornadoes, hail, and everything in between. Of course, our friends in the Carolinas continuing to have deaths and things. From it, and this is truly something that we need to consider, is that just because the hazard has left, the rivers start to subside, people are beginning the recovery process. They're cleaning up their houses and their properties. Two people died last week. One fell off a ladder, the other off of their roof while they were doing recovery efforts. So just knowing that, you know, injuries and things do not stop just because the immediate hazard has left. But kind of looking ahead now, from the past to the present, heavy rain for the upper Mississippi River Valley down to the southern plains through the weekend. Heavy snow, yes, snow, that four-letter S word we all love, from the northern through the central Rockies, and a big cool down for the northern and western United States. So that's a quick look at the disaster weather roundup. Jamie, back to you.
Thanks, Kyle. And that's a, you know, we'll talk a little bit probably in tonight's episode about what the responders in Indonesia are facing with all the deaths there and the things they're dealing with. But we get into that here in a little bit. But Sam, do you want to just go ahead and take it away and we can bring Joe in and our special guest?
Yeah, just back to Kyle for a second. I heard rumors that we might be looking at snow in Colorado. Is there some truth to that?
Absolutely. We have a lot of moisture in place that's actually the remnants of a tropical system that came on shore in California and worked its way to the Four Corners area in the southwestern U.S. Now, that combined with a big cold wave that's coming through later this week into the weekend, where we could definitely see a first significant snowfall of the season in the higher mountain areas in Colorado.
Well, good. You keep it up there. That'd be just fine.
Hey, I'll take all of it I can get.
So, Dr. Joe, how are things in the south in Memphis down there?
Well, I haven't been here very much, but it seems to be okay, despite my very brief time I spent here in the last 3 weeks. So,
yeah, you've been a busy guy. So you finally got through your deployment. Any comments on that since we haven't caught up with you?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, you're right. So things have wound down, although not completed. The IST is still in place with two or three task forces, mostly the water rescue task forces, still in place in South Carolina, having not yet been released. So there is some possibility, if they don't let them go pretty soon, that I'll get to go back and visit again.
The guys that
were able to come in and spell me are about to time out, and I may have to go back and help out again. So we'll see.
Well, you're a dedicated federal employee, and we appreciate that. Well, we have a return guest tonight, Dan McGuire, who's one of our critical incident stress management specialists, and he has a company that evolved around that. And he just did a refresher training, and there's some new stuff going on in the world of CISM. So, Dan, welcome.
Well, it's great to be back, and thank you for the invite. I'm very excited about some of the new stuff to share, because I think it's going to shake some of those folks who have taken the training many years ago and then have never refreshed it. And I just finished doing a basic class locally here. Actually, it was a hybrid class for a team that had been together for many years but had just sort of drifted apart. So we put together a hybrid of the basics but what's new, and they were really surprised and excited about some of these newer things that we need to do more of. It's always been there, but it's not had the attention and the, the mouthwork, that's being me, to get the message out to more of the folks who are out there doing this great work, but realizing that, and this is my standard line, it's no longer just about debriefings anymore.
Well, that would be me. I probably learned this stuff starting in the 80s and trained a lot of people in the original ICISF model. But why don't you tell us about what's new? There's some new terminology, and like you said, it's not about debriefings anymore.
No, and the one thing that I always start off all my classes with, and I'm going to start off tonight with, is we've got to remember, and it's a model that someone gave to me to use for teaching classes, to help us remember where our boundaries are when we're doing any CISM level of work, whether it's a one-on-one SAFER model, whether we're doing a defusing soon after the event, debriefing, follow-up care. And that simply stated is CISM is to psychology as first aid is to surgery. And that's a very important boundary that I'm trying to reiterate out there, because anybody who gets involved in this work gets involved in it for very special reasons. So they're very caring, very giving people. And when we're working with traumatized people, and especially what I call who are still dealing with the raw, unfiltered trauma of the incident or incidents, sometimes our own heart will take us outside of what CISM is really supposed to do, and to turn it more towards a psychotherapeutic event or approach. And that's something that we're trying to get nailed back down as just a basic understanding for everybody is CISM is to psychology, as first aid is to surgery, and keep that in mind as your boundary marker, regardless of the event and regardless of who you're working with, especially if you're working with anyone or any group that you know very well.
No, I agree, because it's easy to breach those boundaries and harm can be done. And, you know, you hear about those situations, which I hate hearing because I strongly believe in the CISM model. But when somebody goes outside those boundaries and creates a problem for someone, then it looks bad for all of us. So I totally agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, it makes us look like we're not well-trained, well-organized. And I have to be very frank. There are teams out there that all they do is offer debriefings, and when I run into them with my travels and programs, it's a real effort to get them to, again, like myself, my very first training was back in the 80s with the ICISF, and then I developed my own company, and it's just like with any... If you're a standard first aider, if you know CPR, you still need to know what's new, and it's not done the same way all the time anymore. And I don't think anything exists like that, whether it's in medicine or if it's in life in general. And and something that I really try to press with, especially working with new teams, the ones who are putting together their very first protocols and so forth and are excited to get out there, is that these boundaries are there for two very solid reasons. One, it's going to protect you, because if you step outside of this boundary and the debriefee, if you will, or debriefees can really think and turn this in their own mind that, you know, I'm working with a mental health professional, which is part of a CISM team anyways. But, again, sometimes our heart and our good intentions and good reasons push us closer because of the intensity of that event. So that's just, again, a boundary that we're trying to reestablish and get people to make sure that they understand that, and when they're setting up a brand new team, that their protocols and their SOGs implement that theory and practice that theory, and that everybody on that team, regardless of your position, if you're a peer or a chaplain or mental health person, that's as far as CISM was designed from the beginning to go. It's that first onset of traumatic stress support. This is not tell me your life history and tell me why purple is your favorite color and anything like that. We have to make sure that we're staying within our fence line is another word that I use.
Well, it's my understanding, Dan, that debriefings are rare. I mean,
well,
there's a lot more other ways of dealing with small groups or dealing with individuals. Debriefings only come along on the really big incidents where there's a lot of people involved and potentially multiple agencies. We did debriefings pretty rarely. So when you're saying there's a company that does mostly debriefings, I'm scratching my head about that.
And that concerns me as well, because if I use the example, any team that is high-fiving themselves out of the room after just doing a debriefing and that's it, and thinking they did a really great job, well, they've done a part of the job, but they haven't done the complete job. And that's where this team that I was just working with, who was reorganizing, were just blown away by the amount of We're not doing these debriefings so often because that's the large event and mixed groups and so forth. And they haven't even been thinking about, and this is the new big thing, and Dr. George Everly wrote a very powerful article about this exact topic, and it's entitled Too Much Too Soon. And that's where these teams who are, again, who don't have well-defined SOGs and practice points and leadership as well, is that if there's any event, we're just going to go do a debriefing because that's what we think is the best thing for everybody. And in Dr. Arbeli's article, he's very frank and open about, and you know, especially within the last 5 years post 9/11, that we were in there way too early, because there's three key things out of that article that he just repeats over and over again in a couple of ways. And that is, number one, we need to take the responsibility as CISM providers and CISM professionals. We need to take the responsibility of understanding our job begins before the critical incident even hits. And that's why there's been more emphasis on trying to help people build their own, what I refer to as their own toolboxes of healthy coping skills and what they have learned through their own life experiences as well. And in the article, he stated, what we have found out we've been doing wrong is it is a much more therapeutic and healthy way of allowing these responders to connect back to what already works for them on a personal basis, such as spending time with a family and doing any type of hobby that has nothing to do with any type of emergency response, and whatever works for them and that's in healthy coping methods, let's allow that natural process to come in because it's familiar to these folks. It's healthy for these folks. And if we're jumping in there even 24 hours, which is way, way, way early in an event to be doing anything like a debriefing, we're interrupting that natural built-in process that these people have. And on the back side of that is that's where teams are not just response teams. We need to be educational teams. Therefore, we need to be out there offering, whether it's a half-hour, 45-minute drill night in service. You know, I've done hundreds of these where we explain, I almost call it like a critical incident stress inoculation lecture, where what might it feel like when you experience one of the worst calls of your young career or your very long career, and let's explain to them that it's okay what you're feeling, what you're thinking, what you're reacting to is absolutely to be expected and normal. It's not something to be ashamed of, and try to breaking down these stigmas is another big part of this whole pre-incident education process that I'm really trying to work with a lot of the teams that I've trained in the past and the ones I'm working with now is, yes, I can teach you how to do a debriefing very well, but what's more important, and I'll go on record, I think it's more important that we get to these people before the trauma gets to them so they have a pre-plan inside of their mind that, again, that they're familiar with and learn things from our own teachings of how to take care of not only ourselves but our peers to not just surviving these events, and this is a model that comes from one of my mentors, is to thrive. How do we help these folks to thrive from what they have just gone through? And while that may sound a little bit high-leveled, high-in-the-sky idea, is there is a big difference between folks just surviving and just getting through life after a traumatic exposure versus how do I take this on in a healthy, positive, open-minded manner and allow these things that I have learned from the CISM team about what happens to our brains, what happens to all the body chemistry, what happens to our thought process and how that gets interrupted, and how do I learn to accept that's okay, that's normal, and that I'm not the odd man out?
Yeah, good point.
You know, it's interesting. I'm hearing that, all that. I'm wondering what Joe's thoughts are on this, because, Joe, you've been through quite a few deployments, some worse than others in terms of the impact on you and your team. And I'm curious how you feel about what Dan's been talking about.
Well, the first thing I'll say is, as you guys know, I am completely mentally healthy. So there's that. No, I'm just kidding. I actually, as I was listening to the conversation, a couple of things struck me. One is how important it is to sort of customize these programs for the incident, the group, the individual, and the team. And how often these things are literally handled by sort of this boilerplate approach of we're all going to get in a room and talk about our experiences without anybody really understanding kind of what the whole point of all of that is. And that we seem to always do this in a very reactionary fashion, right? Nobody ever does anything before a deployment. They always do it afterwards. And so I think those are incredibly valuable points that we could lessen the work and the damage that comes after by doing a little bit of work beforehand.
Yeah, and there's the R word that is out there now as well that came out of Everly's article and some other discussion is with the pre-incident education programs and lectures that we can do is we're trying to build the resiliency right up front. We've got to make sure these folks that are doing, whether it's day-to-day fire EMS or going on major deployments, that they've got some built-in resiliency already there. And then, again, once they go through these traumatic events, let's get them to reconnect them to what's already there post-incident that, again, is familiar and comfortable with them, and that helps open the door for more talking openly about how this event affected me. And the other thing that has been a little bit more focus is validating and normalizing their individual reactions to these critical incidents. And let me say that again, we need to better as both at a individual level and as a group level. And this is weeks, months before we get deployed or have the multiple fatal, whatever it might be, is that they understand that what I'm going to be showing through my own eyes and through my own actions that we need to validate and normalize that those reactions are absolutely years and years alone, and they're there for a reason, and they're the normal process of how the brain and the psyche works. It's no longer this boo-hoo Billy and suck it up suit environment. We have to stop that. We've got too many suicides going on simply due to that that nature within itself. And that's why this whole pre-incident, pre-event education and support and helping them to fill those toolboxes to draw upon when they don't have access to any type of CISM resource right away, that they have those resources in their back pocket or in their backpack, and that they can dip into that to keep themselves going, because we all know we don't like to give up. We don't like to give in. We want to keep going and keep doing the work that we love to do and that we've been trained so well to do.
Well, one of the other things, too, Dan, about debriefings is you're always going to have somebody that's reluctant. And, you know, then there's the issue of should you have mandatory debriefings or not? Because there's going to be somebody that probably really needs it, but he's one of those belly up to the bar types, and he doesn't want to engage. So I've always told these guys, well, you can help your team by just being there. Just be there for support.
Very well said.
In some cases, that person will eventually start coming out with what's on their minds, but it doesn't work for everybody.
No, and it shouldn't be expected. And that's another big push, is we have got to understand, as CISM providers, professionals, not everybody is going to buy in, and this is not going to be their way to process this event. And we have to accept there is going to be that gap, and that we're not going to be able to get through to everyone. It's just not going to work that way.
That's right. And did you mention there is a change in terminology that you learned in this update?
Yes. This is something that actually I caught through a publication that got sent to me through the American Military University. I think I've got that name correct. But there is a push, whenever you say PTSD in front of especially us responders, post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. that automatically makes us retract in and say, whoa, disorder. You're telling me I'm mentally ill, I'm mentally not correct. And just the whole diagnostic process to truly be diagnosed with PTSD is a very several-step approach and process. So the new terminology that we're trying to help responders to even use amongst themselves and to understand is PTSI, post-traumatic stress injury, instead of this disorder we all get injured on the job, especially with the work that we do as emergency responders. That's just part of the job. It's part of the risk of every time that bell goes off, there is a potential of a catastrophic injury, a career-ending injury for us. So, again, just by even using those type of terminology, again, within these pre-education programs and taking that word disorder right out of the vocabulary and the nomenclature of your presentation and using post-traumatic stress injury, that tends to bring way down that scare factor. Oh, what's wrong with me? Am I no longer able to do this? Is this the end of my career? Because I keep hearing PTSD, D, D, where it's perhaps just a temporary injury. And through the right methodologies, and again, if you've got that, what I call our pantries preloaded with all kinds of positive information and tool sets that we can give them, there's incredible work that can be done right over what I call pie and coffee. We're just the two of us could be talking about this very openly and not have to have these large debriefings, as you said, Sam, that we've got those people who will always sit outside the circle. They will not talk. They will not engage. But it's always my hope that if they can stay in and just listen through the process, that they will, at least by some type of osmosis, whether it's psychological osmosis or speech osmosis, that they're going to hear their other peers talk about how they were affected by this, and that can really...
Yeah, I totally agree with
that. Wrong with me.
Yeah, I like that much better as someone who's still being, you know, still in the World Trade Center program. And whenever that comes up, I find myself not always being honest because I don't really want to have a disorder. Thank you very much. Jamie, mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
Well, I like the renaming of it. I think it makes a whole lot more sense. There, as much as we'd like to say we're trying to grow out of it, there is a stigma about anything to do with anything mental illness wise. And so changing it to an injury and refocusing our attention on the fact that this is like a back injury or any other kind of injury you might get on the job in EMS or fire or any other kind of first response, and take that thought process and apply it in the same way to, all right, well, I need physical therapy for my back. Maybe I need to go sit and talk to somebody or have a chat with someone because of my injury, you know? And I think that that's kind of a much more healthful way to look at it. I'm sure Joe probably agrees with me. You talk to a lot of people with a lot of things going on.
I do agree.
So Kyle, you've been taking notes over here. You have any questions for Dan or some thoughts to share?
Well, some thoughts to share. And I like the approach of, as Dan said, kind of filling your pantry or building your toolbox prior to a traumatic event. And I have to give a huge shout out to Pitkin County, which is the agency where I work as a dispatcher. And what we've been all doing as both dispatchers, the sheriff's office, and other user agencies is a program to build that toolbox beforehand. So working with professionals to kind of give us tools to help control some of those thoughts that may get the best of us and to keep us and allow us to kind of self-heal in a way, but then also giving us resources to reach out if we do need additional help. And in just the change in terminology alone, think of what Craig Fugate did. You know, think about his use of terminology. And I'm very deliberate to do this when I'm on the podcast. You know, people that have lived through a disaster, they are not victims. They are survivors. That change in verbiage alone changes the entire mentality of the person who lived through that event. So I applaud you. And I thank you for coming on the show tonight and sharing this. And I hope more agencies will begin to look at this and begin to embrace the terminology of a stress injury versus a stress disorder.
And Dan, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but can you real quick touch on compassion fatigue? Because that's something I think a lot of us feel, but we don't really understand what it is.
Yes, and this is another piece of it's not taught in most basic CISM classes. It's usually taught in the advanced classes. I'm trying to bring it down to every level. Compassion fatigue is exactly that. We are compassionate people who take the time to spend 18 months to become a paramedic, and all the time that we put into all the other trainings that we get, and the time pulled away from our families, and while that work is enjoyable and it gives you a great feeling back that I'm doing something positive, I'm helping not only for that person to just survive, but to help them to thrive beyond the event right now, is we have to be very cautious as CISM providers. Is if a team doesn't have a system, and again, this is something that we started with our team here in Rochester that has worked very well, is we make sure if a team goes out on a call out, they go to the bottom of the list of availability list. And so that gives them time to restore and reconnect. And that's a great way to help reduce that that caretaker fatigue, and that's easily transferable over to nurses and docs and veterinarians and anybody who's in any type of a helping type of career. Is helping just simply hurts at some point. That's where we lose our compassion. That's where we lose our non-judgmental thinking process. And that's a dangerous thing right there. Anyone who's working in the medical field who becomes coarse and tough and judgmental of the people that they're working with, there's absolutely no reason for that person to be on that job. And I know that's a very strong statement. However, that just underscores what we've all been talking about earlier is we have to get to them before it gets to them, which is the title of one of my lectures, is to help them understand that you need to snap off, you need to unplug occasionally from the work that you are dedicated, that you are, that is your life, that is how you are self-identify yourself, how you are identified in your community, how you're identified in your agency. That's all well and good, but we have to make sure that we are literally unplugging from that work often enough, because we can only take on somebody's stories and trauma descriptions and what those scenes were like. And what I referred to before is the imprints of horror, you know, the sights and sounds and smells that these people are going to be telling us. And again, this is raw, unfiltered descriptions. Our minds are built to take just so much of that before we start actually stop caring, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, we're putting our own shields up for our own self-protection, because, you know, our minds get on overload. You can only hear so much of everybody else's trauma. And it starts to affect the peer counselor, whoever you may be in the process. And I fully well understand that. Joe, you have any final thoughts?
Well, the first one is to find the mute button.
Nothing new there.
No, definitely not. You know, I think compassion fatigue or burnout is an absolute huge issue that we do not appreciate the depth and impact that it has on the individual, on the patient, and the risk that it puts in the system just from angry patient, bad outcome, and a provider who seems to not care pretty much guarantees a lawsuit every time. And I think it's, for some reason, people seem to be very challenged with recognizing that they're in that state of mind and that they need to find a healthy way to, you know, vent their frustrations and their fatigue and their anger and everything else. And so I expect we could do an entire podcast on nothing but compassion fatigue.
Well, and that's what I was thinking, too. You know, just as Dan was talking about these things, I'm thinking of all these other topics that could be their own podcasts, like what happens when the responder comes home and deals with their family. I mean, there's just so much stuff. We'll have to get you back on, Dan, because there's just so much. This was just the verbal type, tip of the iceberg, if you will. Jamie, your thoughts? Go ahead, Dan.
That's one other topic that I am beating the bushes with these teams, is we have a direct responsibility to not only educate the responders on what they may feel like after the event, we've got to educate their family, because when their loved one goes out the door, their loved one and comes back in the door, someone they can't even recognize or communicate with, we have a responsibility to help that family to understand what is happening in that responder's mind and body and soul, if you will, and what can they say and what not to say, what to do, what not to do. We owe these responders' family members this same information, care, and support.
Absolutely, and they need to know what to expect. So let's talk about... So that's a topic in and of itself. And I also want to talk more about the dispatch side and what we can do to help them. Jamie, you got some final thoughts there?
Yeah, I do. I just like the way this has gone, to talk a little bit about how we start working with people before the problem starts and before they run into that situation that is going to take them beyond their coping mechanisms and maybe build up those coping mechanisms a little more beforehand, build that resiliency, as Kyle talked about. And Joe, this is one of the things I'm curious about, because I know at Paragon, where you guys are doing all this training, I'm sure this is something that comes up as part of the program. Is this something that you guys like to bring up more frequently, or is it part of just the beginning of the program, or do you work it out throughout the project as you do this experiential training that you guys do?
Well, I think that's part of the stress immersion, you know, idea here, is that those are the things that you don't see and may not be apparent, but may result in bad judgment and bad outcomes and, you know, things happening that you don't want to happen. And it's absolutely essential to consider all those things as you're looking at, you know, planning a training event. As well as reviewing the response of your team or individuals to a major event of any sort.
So if folks want to find out a little bit about where they can find out more about this stress immersion experience that you guys really put together for your training programs, where can they reach out to you and find out more?
They can find us on the web at ParagonMedicalEducationGroup.com. Or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group as well, and they can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
And we'll make sure we continue to give you guys a shout-out for all your continued support here at the podcast. Dan, where can folks find out more about the projects you're doing and where you're out there doing training around the country, really? I know you go all over the place.
Yes, and I shudder to think how many times I'm going to be away from home in the next 4 weeks. But anyways, on the website, it's simply our company name, CISMperspectives.com. Same thing for Facebook. Just type in CISM space perspectives, and there we are. And I'm always on that every day, all day. And have program will travel. This is the most rewarding work that I've done, in excess of all of the EMS work that I did for 29 years. And by helping responders to not burn out, to not to hit a wall and not know what to do, that is what I want to do for the rest of my life, and that's what makes my hair stand on end, is when I can say the right thing and I can see the change in that person's body language, eyes, as the eyes are the windows to the soul. That's what I live to do.
We appreciate the fact you're doing it, Dan. I wish there were more of you out there.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you.
Definitely. Thanks for coming on. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WXKyleNelson. So feel free to follow along on Twitter and Instagram and connect with me on LinkedIn as well.
Great. And thanks for coming on with the weather outlook. And it's great to have you back on the show. I know we've been kind of missing you because you've been working a lot of nights, but it's great to have you back on.
Thanks, Jamie. Always good to be on.
Sam, how about you?
Well, we have to give a shout out to our other meteorologist who is traveling at the moment. So if she's listening to this, hello, Becky. I'm in the same place as you'll find Kyle, under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, disasterpodcast.com website, and on our Facebook group under Disaster Podcast. What about you, Jamie?
Well, folks can find me under the handle Podmedic in most social media locations out there. So look me up, friend, follow, or otherwise check in with me there. And, of course, always find us on our Facebook group over at Disaster Podcast. Just search for Disaster Podcast in Facebook and ask to join the group. We'd love to have you in there. We're continuing to grow. Lots of good conversations and things going on over there. And you can definitely check in and become part of the community there. Sam, this has been a great talk. You know, it's been a while since we've had Dan on and talked about this topic, but it's probably something we should make an effort to revisit more frequently.
I agree, and especially with everything else that's going on in the world. I mean, thinking about Indonesia right now, especially, we'd like to get some more information on that. But we're definitely going to get Dan back. There's just so many things to talk about in relation to CISM and so forth. But, you know, see, what's a good tagline for this? Disaster mental health is not our everyday mental health.
I like that.